Welcome to Cultimatum, the podcast uncovering the dark realities of cults and human trafficking. I'm your host, Anonymous Andrew, and each week we dive deep into the manipulation, control, and courageous escapes that define these worlds.
And I'm Melody, Andrew's co-host. Having experienced the depth of a cult firsthand, specifically the House of Yahweh, I am here as an advocate for fellow survivors.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests are their own and do not reflect the official policy or position of Cultimatum or its affiliates. The content discussed on this podcast are based on personal experiences and should not be construed as factual or legal advice. Neither the host nor the guest are liable for any statements made during the episodes. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and seek professional advice where appropriate.
And before we dive into today's episode, we want to issue a trigger warning. Some episodes may cover explicit and potentially disturbing subjects such as sexual abuse, rape, human trafficking, suicide, and other sensitive subjects. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Cultimatum Podcast, the culture of cults and human trafficking, and my name is Anonymous Andrew, and with me today is my co-host Melody. Hello, Melody.
Hi, Andrew. We have a special guest today. We are covering another cult that we have not covered yet. The name of the cult is the 12 Tribes Cult, and our guest is Tamara Matthew. And she is an author who wrote a book about the subject called All Who Believed. Tamara, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much.
Yes, welcome, Tamara. And I'm going to address you as Tammy, so I pronounced Tammy correctly.
Okay.
So where would you like to start? Tell us about your book, maybe?
Yeah, so I, after my family left the 12 Tribes in 2014, you know, it's a lot to process. We had been there 14 years, and so I just started, you know, just kind of journaling, you know, writing down things that I remembered. And just over time, it grew and grew. And I thought, you know, maybe I could turn this into something. And so that's how my book started out.
Can you tell us a little bit about the 12 tribes?
Mm-hmm, yep, the 12 tribes.
And you consider them a cult?
Yes.
Okay. Why?
Yes. Very high control group. People that join give up everything to move in there. Once you're there, you don't have your own money anymore. You don't have your own freedoms. You submit to the authority of the group. You have people that are covering you that tell you what you're doing that day. Really, you know, strict rules for raising children. It's just day in, day out, you know, we gatherings twice a day. But what it is, you know, it's an end times group. So they follow the Bible, but they don't consider themselves a part of mainstream Christianity at all. They feel like they have separated from mainstream Christianity and that they are God's chosen people on the earth that have been chosen to bring about the end of the age, the return of Yahshua. They call Jesus by his Hebrew name, Yahshua. And they started out in the 70s as just like a branch off from a church. So there was the original people that started the 12 tribes, Marcia and Gene Spriggs. They lived in Chattanooga. They were attending a church. They started inviting young people to their homes for Bible study. They would have these gatherings in parks where people would just speak their mind and read the Bible. And, you know, just kind of started out simple like that. And then as their story goes, they were all attending this church, and the church canceled one of their Bible studies for Super Bowl party, and they didn't think that the Super Bowl had anything to do with God's purpose, and so they decided to separate from that church and become their own church. So they became the Vinehouse Christian Community, and Gene and Marcia Spriggs opened their home to people. Young people started moving in. They started opening up delis where they could all work together. That's how it started in the beginning. Eventually, they all migrated up north to Island Pond, Vermont, where there were more people that gave up their homes. At one point, the little town of Island Pond, Vermont had like 13 households that were 12 tribes households, you know, but their purpose was to spread the message to the ends of the earth. Like that's what the gospel needs to be preached to the ends of the earth before the end times can come. So they started sending people out all over the world. And now they have communities, you know, South America, Brazil, Argentina, over in Europe, they're in France, Czech Republic, England, they're in Japan, they're in Australia. They've really branched out, but their numbers sort of, you know, I would say their numbers probably don't really get above 5,000. Like some of these communities might only have like a handful of people living in them at one time. So there's a lot of places, but I think their numbers have really been dwindling, especially over the past few years.
So how did you and your family get involved in the cult or find the cult? Were you, and how old were you at the time that you joined?
Was 23 when we joined. And my husband has an aunt who joined the Island Pond community back in 1981. She joined with her family. So he grew up knowing about the community, and he was raised as a, like a Pentecostal, born-again Christian, that kind of church. But they would visit from time to time Island Pond. So, but it was just kind of a, to him, it was just like a group that his aunt and cousins were a part of. You know, he liked going there. He thought it was, people were nice, but he didn't really give it much thought for his own life. So then when he and I got married, I was introduced to the 12 tribes community through his relatives. And that's where I became intrigued by them. I was a new mother, you know, I was 22 when my son was born and just became a stay-at-home mom really young. And I saw this group where people lived together, you know, mothers had each other for support from the outside. It just seemed so, kind of like old-fashioned, and I just was so excited, like, to realize that there was this other lifestyle available out there, and I just became very intrigued, wanted to visit more and more and get to know people.
So that's what drew you to this, I'll say it, cult.
Yeah, it was, that was the lifestyle that drew me in. I wasn't raised religious, so it definitely wasn't like, oh, I love how these people believe the Bible. I love their doctrine. It wasn't anything like that. It was just the people were so nice and so welcoming, and it appealed to me in like this aesthetic sense, you know, just the simplicity, like it seemed so wholesome, you know, kids
safe. Work.
Yes, it seemed very safe. It seemed very family oriented. And it just, you know, at a time when there was that Columbine shooting, and that really affected me as a young mother. And like, I wanted somewhere just safe and wonderful to raise my child in. And I just, you know, I just thought that it was so amazing that this lifestyle existed. You know, they weren't watching TV. And so
About what year is this?
1999.
So there weren't really cell phones and computers, that they weren't that common back then. It was
right. Like there was the internet, but not like it was today. I didn't have a way of sort of getting the other side to the story back then. You know, there were definitely people who had left the group. You know, they'd already been around for 20 something years, but there just wasn't a lot to find out back then.
I assume that you recognize some of that welcoming feeling that you got in the beginning now as love bombing, as actually a cult tactic at this point. But I also have a question for you about some of the stuff that I've read about the group in particular. Is it more strict for women in the group in general? Because I know like in the restaurants or the delis that they run, that women aren't usually seen on the scenes of those. If they are, they're in the background. Can you share a little bit about your personal experience or what you know about any of that?
Yeah, we had a cafe in Cambridge, but the women weren't in the background there. I mean, I worked in the cafe. my mother-in-law worked a lot in the cafe. I think maybe some of that thinking comes from like a lot of the young teenage girls will be doing a lot of the baking and stuff like that in the back. But I never heard anything like that was a rule for our cafes or something. But women are expected to be submissive. It's a patriarchal society. So women just have a certain role. Women are subservient, you know, and that's across the board. That's to their husband. That's to any male in the group. Women aren't disrespectful to any male. So it definitely affects, you know, I'm sure how things seem in the day-to-day life to others.
My next question would be, since you went in when you didn't go in with your original family, meaning your parents, mm-hmm, were right. you isolated from your extended family when you were part of the group, and how exactly were you isolated?
So when you join, they don't purposefully isolate you. Like, we chose to move to Hyannis, Massachusetts. We were coming from Burlington, Vermont. Our family was in Vermont. We made that choice to move into Hyannis, Massachusetts. We could have moved into Rutland, Vermont, if we wanted to. But my family especially was struggling with our choice. And, but you know, we just felt so sure that we were doing the right thing, and we just wanted like a clean start. And we had visited the community in Hyannis a lot because my husband's relatives had been living in that particular community, and we really liked everybody down there. And we just thought it would be like a good place to start, like get some distance from my family, give them some time to accept, you know, what we did and all that. So like, that was our choice. Like, they didn't tell us, oh, you've got to move to this community that's, you know, 200 miles away or whatever, you know, from your family. And once we were there, I was able to, like, there was phones. I was able to, like, call. There wasn't any restrictions about that. It's only when families actively try to start discouraging you from what you're doing, then you would be encouraged, you know, to, like, hey, these people are trying to prevent you from doing God's will. And there's that verse in the Bible of, like, he who hates his father and mother hates the gospel. And it's not like the community would always talk about that verse and how, you know, you're not literally hating them, like an emotional, like, I despise you, I hate you, but you're just hating anything that's going to keep you from being obedient to God. You were chosen out of all the billions of people on the earth. God chose you to be a part of his true people on the earth. And so you're going to hate anything that's going to get in the way of that. So if your parents are constantly, you know, calling and writing and trying to convince you to leave, you would cut that off because that's like the evil one's influence, you know, through your family. But if you like, my family never was like that. So they were always welcome to come visit us. And, you know, we would go and visit them, but it wasn't on our own terms. You know, I couldn't be like, hey, I'm going to go visit my dad this weekend. You had to submit that. My husband would have to submit to the counseling government of whatever community that we're in. Hey, my wife and I have a burden to go visit her family, you know, and then the government would talk about it if they had faith to send us, and then we would be sent. Like, that's how it worked. It did the other way around. Like, if my family wanted to come, they could call me and be like, hey, we're going to be in town this weekend. And that was fine. You know, we would reorganize or whatever. If I was making dinner, you know, somebody would cover so that I could visit with my family. Or, you know, we always wanted to welcome people because we always had the hope that that was going to be a light to them, that they were going to see what we saw. So as long as there's that hope, like, you're reaching out, your family's welcome.
Yeah, because so they could recruit them.
So exactly.
Yeah. Okay. You mentioned your son. You have one son?
Two.
Oh, you have two.
When we joined, I just had one 17-month-old child.
Where did they attend school?
In the 12 tribes.
Oh, so they educate. They have their own school.
Uh-huh. Yep. It's considered homeschool, but each parent wasn't teaching our own children. We had groups, and it was just like, you know, we would send them off with their, we called it training. We didn't call it school. So we would send them off with their training groups in the morning, and they'd come home in the afternoon, just like, you know, regular school.
Next question is, when did you begin to I don't know if critical thinking applies here. When did you begin to think that this was not a good idea? That
about 2 months after we joined.
Wow.
Wow, that's quick. That's quick.
Yeah. But yet you so what happened 2 months in?
It was culture shock for me. I did not know what I had gotten myself into. I was overwhelmed. I missed my family, my friends, my independence. It was really hard to adapt to being a mother of that age child, with the strictness and the expectations of children. I just, you know, you worked really hard. I didn't have much free time. Like, I was in the kitchen most days or doing laundry, and then you're given single brothers laundry to do. So laundry was a big thing. Like, you know, I went from being in my home alone, kind of being bored and not knowing how to fill the days and wanting more for my child, to suddenly just feeling so overwhelmed and, you know, trying to keep my toddler, you know, by my side working in the kitchen for hours. And I didn't know how to, you know, that was not, I didn't know how to do that.
It's not what you signed up for. Right.
No, and then I thought it was going to be really family oriented. I thought, you know, that I would see my husband more. We'd be able to do more things as a family. But, you know, he was put on a work crew and they would leave early in the morning and not get home until, you know, right before our gatherings in the evenings. And we had the Sabbath, which was Saturday. We had that one day. And then Sunday was just another day back to work. So I was seeing my husband a lot less than what I was used to, plus trying to acclimate to everything from like complete change of wardrobe, complete change of diet, you know, complete change of like lingo and things that you do or don't talk about. And it was, you know, it was like going into a whole different culture. And I started to miss the life that we had had that I wanted so badly, you know, to not have. I felt like I was going crazy. So I called my mother-in-law crying one night, just telling her how much I hated it there. And she felt really responsible for us being there because, you know, it was really through her, through their side of the family, that I met the community and became so enamored. So she, you know, I just remember crying to her and saying, I just need a break. I just want to like sit down and watch a movie. So, she told my husband, you know, that I had called her. And so then he and this other man in the community, like sat down to have a meeting with me.
Uh-oh.
And yeah, it was like the first time that my husband had kind of used his husbandly authority. And I just, all I remember is just sitting there crying and just saying, I want to go home. I just want to go home, and crying. And the other man, we called him Banabi in the community. And he was super, like, him and his wife came and visited us in our house in Burlington before we moved in. Like, they were at our wedding, like helping clean up and stuff. He was a really nice man. Like, I liked him. And I just remember him looking at me and saying, but you are home. And then I remember looking over at my husband and he said, we're not going anywhere. And I just,
oh,
it was awful. I just felt like the walls of the room just like shrunk in. And I was like, what did I do? Yeah, that was a really hard, hard time.
I have a two-part question here. Okay, so you started having these doubts 2 months in, but you stayed for 14 years.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
My first part of my question is, did you stop believing at that two-month period, or did you think that it was just Satan or the evil one tempting you or something, and then were able to get yourself into the cult-like thinking during that time? So I'll let you answer that first, and then I have another part to that question after that. So go ahead.
Yeah, it was absolutely some of that, because I had gotten baptized. And so I remember going to talk to one woman and telling her, like, maybe it didn't work, you know, like maybe I wasn't sincere because I'm not feeling like this grace, you know, from God that I thought being baptized was going to suddenly bestow on me. I remember her telling me that that's normal. You know, when you've given your life to God, when you've become part of his holy people, you are going to be bombarded from the evil one with doubts. And like, that's his trick, that he's trying to get you. You're a threat to him now. You're a threat to the evil one. So he's going to try anything to get you to think that you've done something wrong. And then I remember clearly one woman telling me that it was like I was saved from a burning building. Like the whole world is hopeless, is condemned. The whole world is like a burning building. And God like plucked me out of it and saved me, took me out of the burning building. And what I was experiencing was it was as though I wanted to go back in the burning building. Like, maybe it's not so bad. Maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought. Like, I just want to go back in one more time and just see. But I needed to trust that it's death out there. It's death out there, that I was saved, that I didn't need to turn around and go back in the burning building, that they were my friends telling me, no, you know, now you're safe. So yeah, I was told all those things. And we had gatherings twice a day. So in the 12 tribes, you have a gathering in the morning and a gathering in the evening. And that's where people share all these types of revelations or Bible verses, or there's constant teachings. And so somebody might bring up something from the teaching, and anybody can share, down to children. Children could share at the 12 tribes gathering. And there's a lot of singing and dancing. So the gatherings always start out singing and dancing, happy, and then people start sharing. So the indoctrination is continual, day in and day out. And I'm sure a lot of the things in the gatherings around that time were probably tailored to me and my husband, you know, being new and knowing that I, more, you know, way more so than my husband, like I was really struggling. So there was a lot of that. And then my husband had a cousin and his wife that I'd gotten to know when we were visiting, and they had moved out of Hyannis. But once I started doing really bad, they moved back, and she was my age, and we were both newly pregnant, and we both had a little boy. Then it was like I suddenly felt like I had a friend again, like I had somebody, you know, that was kind, that I could talk to. And that helped, just like having a person felt like was my friend, really helped get me through that time.
So the second part of my question is then, what happened at the 14-year mark to cause you to leave, or were you excommunicated? How did that all play out?
Nope.
And what was it that, what was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, that caused you to wake up and leave?
So there were many times over the years that, I mean, my husband knew that I wasn't happy a lot of the time. And he has a degree. And so he was one of the few people there that could really run a business. And so he rose up pretty quickly to, when we got to Cambridge, he was put in charge of this soap shop. And within a couple years of us being there, it was a huge moneymaker. He was able to get all this private label work for big companies. And the community in Cambridge, we were able to support a lot of other communities that weren't doing so well through our soap shop industry. So he dealt with any doubts or unhappiness by just throwing himself into this. You know, he called the soap shop like his baby. And it really did help take care of a lot of people. And so he always had something in him, like, you know, he couldn't just drop that ball and have our family leave. Like, that would have devastated not only the community of Cambridge, but the community in Argentina where we sent money to, and other communities where we were helping to support. For a long time, that pretty much kept him going, was this industry. And it wasn't until we started having teenagers, and raising teenagers is not, you know, it's not a good time in 12 tribes. So, you know, a lot of things were coming up with our teenagers, and the realization that if they didn't want to be here, that if they left, it was like, that's like the ultimate failing as a parent. So when you guys were talking about, you know, how do they isolate you from families? And I was saying, well, like as a new convert, they don't really, you know, tell you, you know, unless your family is actively trying to dissuade you. But the snake in the grass is that once you're there and you've raised your children, it's the children who've left. That's where they really isolate families. So children who leave that have been raised there, they say that they would be better off not to even have been born. You know, as parents, you know, they're really supposed to be dead to you. That's where the big isolation comes in, is the people that grow up there and leave, and they are cut off from any communication with other siblings in the group, even their parents a lot of times. And as parents, it's like the biggest shame you could imagine. It's the kind of thing like, okay, you had, God gave you one job, you know, gave you the job to raise this child according to his plan. You had all the tools needed. You know, we had this big thick child training manual. We had child training meetings every week. We were all supposed to be going to each other. Anytime we saw somebody not being really diligent, you know, disciplining their child or whatever. So it was like we had everything we needed to raise children who were going to take on this life and move it forward. And they were going to have children and do the same, you know, and we failed. And so like as a parent who fails and your child leaves, like you're going to pay for that in death. Like the parent is going to pay for that in death, you know, and then your children are just, they're going to go to the lake of fire because they knew the truth and they weren't faithful to it.
So am I hearing that your one or both of your children left?
No, but we were seeing that as a possibility on the horizon, especially with our older son. You know, he was 15 at the time, and Emmett is just who he is. Like, he was never going to pretend to be anybody that he was not. He was watching his friends get baptized, and he just kind of saw through a lot of stuff, and he wasn't going to have any of it. He wasn't interested.
No.
And so, yeah, he went through a lot, and there were just corrections coming at us left and right, and at the time, they seemed like a really big deal, really terrible things that he was doing, such as he was caught reading Tom Sawyer, such as he was caught listening to country music while waiting in a vehicle for somebody. Those things there were like really bad. That was like really bad. And I had a hard time to think of them, those things, as really bad. And we had a really strict rule that any children or teens couldn't have any interaction with each other unless there was an adult present there to monitor their conversation, because, you know, surely the children weren't going to be having any meaningful conversations about the Proverbs. And so that was a really strict rule. So, you know, my 15-year-old son could not be out on the porch playing guitar with his, you know, another 15-year-old by themselves. Somebody would come to me, hey, these two boys are out here uncovered. Like, where are they supposed to be? Like, it was really strict like that. So after one of those times when Emmett got in trouble because he talked to someone and he said to me, didn't you have friends when you were my age? And like, that really cut me. And I really realized how restrictive this life was. And I realized that I couldn't imagine being a teenager there. I look back on high school and my friends, and I'm just thought, oh my goodness, like, I'm so glad that I wasn't raised here. And then that really caused me to be like, whoa, how can I feel that way? And yet I'm subjecting my children to being raised here.
And I'm going to ask the question just naturally, because you mentioned 15-year-old boy. Those sex hormones are flowing too. So naturally, I know when I was 12, 13, 14, I was looking at Playboys and I was looking at girls. And I, you know what I'm saying? It's that prepubescent or adolescent hormones where they're running rampant. And so what was the cult's protocol on dating? Obviously, there could be no dating.
No.
Couldn't be alone with the woman. No. But so he must have had those thoughts.
Oh, yeah. And if, and I saw this happen, if two teenagers were ever caught having an inappropriate relationship, and that could be as minimal as like holding hands, touching over clothing, or like a kiss. Okay. So two 16-year-olds are caught they are given the choice to marry each other when they were of age or leave the community. That was the choice they were given. And I saw such a marriage that had to happen between like two 17-year-olds. That's how strict it was. Children, the closest thing to dating was called a waiting period. And it was like everything was all about permission. So if there were, you know, and not before they were 18, it wasn't like underage marriages weren't like condoned. So say two 18-year-olds decide they like each other. It's like they'd have to go to their parents. Hey, I like so-and-so. I want to go on a waiting period. The parents would have to talk. The community elders would have to get together and all have faith about it. And then these two people would, and this is for adults too. This would be for like two 40-year-olds that join the community and decide they like each other. It's the same protocol. They go on what's called a waiting period where they still can't be alone or touch each other at all, but they're just, it's okay for them to like be on the same weekend team together or be on the same breakfast morning together or have more times, maybe a cafe shift together. They have more times where they can be together, but in a completely public surroundings. And so that way the other people in the community can watch how they interact, because it's all about if everybody has faith, you know? So then the waiting period goes well and the two people are like, yeah, we want to get married. Well, then the whole body has to have faith. There has to be a meeting. And if anybody has a reservation, that has to be taken seriously. So if everybody has faith about it, then the people are put on what's called a betrothal. And then like their hands, like we'd be in our big gathering and the people would be called up front and their hands would be joined together and they would be married 7 weeks from that point. So for those 7 weeks, they could hold hands, but that was it. They still had no, like, they still couldn't be alone. They could only hold hands. It wasn't until the wedding day that they have their first kiss after their vows. And then they're sent away for their wedding night. So it's very strict in that way of,
wow,
you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
W-O-W, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, so we expected our teenagers to just be so good, you know, and...
But it's not natural.
It's not natural. Oh, we lived in this huge mansion in Cambridge, New York. And so my kids told me after we left that them and the other teenagers, they had devised this whole system of places in the house where they would hide notes to each other. You know, it might be like under a radiator in this closet or down in the basement behind this rice tote, or they had all these different places they would put notes and they would have like code words that they would say to each other in passing. That just was like a, you know, whatever, or a noise, or I don't know, to know like, hey, there's a note for you at this certain, I mean, so they devised a way.
They developed a system.
To communicate because they were kids and they wanted. They wanted to have relationships with, you know, normal relationships. They weren't wanting to, I don't know, do all this evil stuff together.
It was their version of Snapchat.
Right, exactly. Their little letters. And if that had been found out, I mean, that would have been a huge thing. Yeah. They all would have been in so much trouble. It would have been terrible.
It's just not natural. And I'm going to ask this question because it astounded me the last interview we had, and Melody even came out and spoke about it. Was there any dictation or protocol about how you and your husband were intimate?
Pretty much, yeah.
Like you had to have vanilla sex, and because we interviewed somebody just last week, and then Melody told us that she was handed a pamphlet about how she was supposed to be intimate with her husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's very clear teachings, especially for like two people that grew up there who are getting married, who don't know anything about anything. There's really clear teachings of like how to do things. It was pretty clear that you don't do oral sex. That was off the table.
Even married?
Yes. There were teachings on masturbation. Like it was okay for men who were single, but it wasn't okay for women who were single. Because men had a physical need for release, but women don't. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, there are teachings on all that, but like, you know, there were things like, you know, there'd be married women's meetings a lot, where we would be taught about our purpose and how to be, you know, like say like the first when you have your period, you are unclean for 7 days. And on the eighth day, it's expected that you would come together. That was the community word. We didn't say have sex. We said come together. It was just a given that you were supposed to let your husband know on the eighth day that you were clean and, you know, that you were ready. And you never denied your husband's request for sex.
I'm going to assume, based on that comment alone, that you followed the Old Testament laws and the Bible, because Michael was very, you were saying that, and I'm like, oh yeah, and there was probably an ablution that had to happen on that eighth day. If it was the same or similar teaching to my cult, is that the case? Did you follow the 613 laws in the Old Testament?
We'd have to shower. You know, we were always supposed to shower after sex. Like, sex made you unclean.
Oh, God.
So you were always supposed to shower after that. We followed the rules for childbirth. So, like, after having a boy, you were unclean for 40 days. And after having a girl, you were unclean for 80 days.
Yeah, that's all Old Testament law teachings. Yep.
Well, yep. Wait. What does that mean? What? So you have, which is why.
It's in the Bible, Andrew. It is in the Bible. I'm just going to say.
Okay. Exactly. Naturally, I missed that part. Well, I went to Catholic high school and took theology in college, and I went to a Catholic university. I missed that part. So after you give childbirth, you're unclean?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So meaning, I guess that means you can't have sex for those 40 days. Okay.
Yes.
Well, that.
I mean, the 40 days, that's like a standard in the medical world.
Yeah.
Know? The 80 days, even the community said that they weren't 100% sure why it was twice as long. And their thinking was that our father allotted that time because a mother would need that additional time to bond with a daughter, that a mother and son bond quicker and have an easier relationship, but a mother and daughter would need the extra time. That was the only guess that I ever heard as to why, because the Bible doesn't say why it's 40 days for a boy and 80 for a girl.
Wow. Okay. So take us to, I guess, the part B of Melody's question was, when did you walk away and how, and walk us through that.
So once my husband came to the point where he could admit that he also was not happy and wanted to leave, once he started having earnest conversations with other men, the community did what they typically do in that situation, and that was to send us somewhere far away. So we were living in Cambridge, New York, and it was a Tuesday, and it was my supper night, and I was pulled outside by another leading couple. And my husband was a leader at this time. Like, he became the community coordinator. He functioned in government. He traveled around, went to meetings. And so, yeah, I was pulled outside and I was told that our family was needed to go down to Arcadia, Florida, where there was a small community of people. And there was one 60-year-old man trying to support them by going out and fixing people's swimming pools. And this is like summertime. This was the middle of June. And so, you know, it was like, hey, you know, we were asked, but not asked, if you know what I mean. Like, they knew we were on the edge of leaving. And so it was like, hey, you know, is your family, you know, you guys willing to go and do this? And at that time, my family had never done something like that before. We'd never had the chance to travel like that. Or so, you know, there was a bit of excitement. And I they asked me, you know, can you still do dinner tonight? We want you guys to leave on Thursday. Okay. So, you know, I got to pack up my, you know, I had a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old and 15-year, you know, pack up our family of six to drive down to Florida, you know, and I'm being asked this on Tuesday afternoon and told that we're leaving Thursday morning. I called my mom because my mom had always tried to help us out. And this is in my book, and this is a whole different tangent, but my grandmother, her mother, joined the 12 tribes community and lived with us in Cambridge. And my in-laws eventually ended up joining too. So we lived in Cambridge with my in-laws, my grandmother, And all those times when these people joined, it all served to make me think like we really were doing God's purpose, because we did have other family members being drawn and coming in. But anyway, so my mother was like a big part of our lives because we were there and her mother was there. So she visited us all the time. She was always trying to help us do nice things for the kids. So, you know, I didn't tell anybody else I did this, but I called my mom and I was like, hey, you know, would you want to like give us some money and help us? Like, we get to go to Florida. We'd like to maybe take the kids to a zoo and like just do some fun things with them. And she was able to help us out in that way. And so we just made an adventure of it for the kids. We spent 3 days on Assateague Island in Maryland. And we met up with one of my mom's friends in North Carolina and took the kids to a zoo, just all this stuff that they'd never done. Our family had never had a time where we were just us out doing fun things together. So it was irresistible, you know, when we were offered that. And so we took our time, took like a week getting down to Florida, and we did stop at other 12 tribes communities on the way, because there's like Asheville, North Carolina, Savannah, Georgia, you know, we stopped and saw those places. So we made it to Arcadia and we were there for 6 weeks. And I think over that time, just people that we had left behind in Cambridge who were just part of the people who were constantly having meetings with us, constantly calling out our teenagers for things, just really oppressive people. They ended up coming down to Florida too. And all of a sudden we're back in meetings with them about one day I bought my kids like Greek yogurt from the store and we were told that we were pandering our kids and giving into their fleshly appetites. And my daughter, I found her like a Nancy Drew book on the side of the road at some yard sale and the book was found. And so she, you know, once again, we were in trouble for a book. And finally, we heard this couple was coming for yet another meeting with us. And that's when my husband was like, we're not going. And in Florida, we were given these two little cottages kind of on the outskirts of the property. Like, it was the most removed that we'd ever been. You know, we lived in a household with sometimes 60 other people. And suddenly we have these like two little cottages, you know, a little bit of freedom. And my husband said, no, we're not going. I'm going to tell them that we're sick. And like, he'd never done something. So, you know, it was like, really? Like, we're just going to hide out back here and like not go to the meeting? Like, that was a big deal. And then he said, you know, why don't you call your mom, you know, find out if we can stay with her for a bit. He started making phone calls to find out if his brother had any potential work for him. Like, we seriously were like, that's it. Like, we're not doing this anymore. And so one morning we got everybody up at 4 a.m. and loaded up and drove back up to Vermont.
Oh, you went back to Vermont?
We went back to Vermont. Yeah, we drove from Arcadia. Yep, back up to Vermont.
But not back to the 12 tribe.
Mm-mm.
No.
No, we bypassed Cambridge. I had to call my grandmother. That was really hard. Called his parents, you know, because like I said, to them, that was a huge ordeal. I told my grandmother, like, if you want to live with us, like, you know, we'll always take care of you. She chose to stay. My grandmother stayed.
So what year is this that you left?
2014.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. My in-laws left a year and a half after us, and now they live 2 miles down the road.
And it's fair to say you never look back, other than writing your book. I meant that rhetorically.
Yeah, I mean, it was only while my grandmother was still alive. She passed away in 2019. So for those first 5 years, I would go to Cambridge. I would still go and visit her. They let her. I mean, she wasn't really a threat. You know, she was like a 80-year-old woman. I don't think that they were worried about her coming up here and being defiled by our family. So she came up and would spend a few days with me. They would like meet us somewhere halfway. And
so you enrolled your children into regular public school at that point?
The two younger ones, yes. First and fourth grade, we put them right into school, but my two older ones were terrified to go into public school.
Of course.
So I homeschooled them for 2 years.
And your husband, being a businessman, mm-hmm. He found work?
Yeah, because he had been running this big soap shop industry. He had a lot of connections that were not 12 tribes from all these other businesses and companies that he got the private label work. So he had a lot of references. So he was able to get into another body care manufacturer in Essex, Vermont, like pretty quickly. And he was with that company for like 5 or 6 years. And now he's doing private consulting from home with a different company.
Walk us through your deprogramming, or was there any?
There wasn't anything like official. We all had therapy of some sort, and we all connected often with other people who had left, just to know like how we were feeling was normal, what our children were going through was normal. I did advocate for all my children to have therapy.
Were your kids excited when you left, or were they scared? I mean, how did they feel when you had made that decision that you were leaving? Because I'm sure it was a little confusing for them.
Yeah, it was. I know that for Emmett, for our oldest, he was excited at first. Just, I remember him and my daughter watching, you know, my husband had a laptop and they really loved Walker Texas Ranger and Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman. It was like all these things were so new to them, you know, and I was trying to find them shows that I thought were like, you know, a little bit more on the wholesome side. You know, there was things that I was scared of them, you know, getting involved with right away. But what he suffered about is, even though it was strict in the community and he wasn't, you know, they weren't allowed like normal friendships, it was still like those were the people that he'd grown up with. Those were the only people that he knew. He didn't know anybody except for relatives, you know. And so he tried calling the community and they would not let, you know, of course, he wasn't allowed to talk to anybody. So he was angry at us for that, for just taking him away from anybody that he knew. But at the same time, he was really excited to try new things. He got to try Taekwondo. He got to, he discovered he loved flying. He pursued his junior pilot's license. Like before he got his driver's license, he did a solo in an airplane. And like he was able to suddenly have all these things he wanted to do, and we could support him and not tell him like, oh, that's just like a worldly, fleshly, selfish desire. So, and my daughter was able to like get a job and work on a farm, and like, you know, they were very excited to be able to like work and get paid and make money. Like that was totally a novel concept for them. And my little ones, you know, they were young. They didn't know any better. Yeah, they went to school and made friends. They were just little kids.
Wow.
Yep.
Okay. Wow. All right. Tell us a little bit about your book, the name of it, and...
Yep, it's All Who Believed, a memoir of life in the 12 tribes. And it goes through, you know, exactly how I met the community, what drew me there, that whole thing, joining. And then it's just different stories over the years that, you know, really stood out to me, just to try to highlight what it's like to be a mother there and raise your children and the expectations and the discipline and everything. I really tried to include all aspects of life, because like I said, when I joined, there wasn't anything like that. And I really thought like I could put something out there that would give people a more clear idea. You know, people are still joining, they're still recruiting, you know, at least now, you know, somebody could read my experience, and my experience was my own. I make that really clear. Like everybody's experience in the 12 tribes is so different depending where you live and who you live with. And some people are more principled and legalistic, and some people want to have more fun. And it's so different. And some people have been there for 30, 40 years and love their life there. And other people had like experiences like way worse than me. You know, people ask me about sexual abuse, and I had my home births. They all went great. Not everybody's did, you know, but I make it clear in my book, like I stick to my story and what it was like for me. You know, there's a lot more horrendous stories out there, but those are their stories if they ever want to tell them. I wasn't going to get into other people's experiences.
Not your story to tell, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I really just wanted it to be a really realistic, like, you know, and it goes through the years, like this is what my life was like.
Where, I'm going to ask you a slightly personal question. Where is your faith today? Do you belong to a religion?
I don't belong to a religion. I am definitely would be okay if I didn't open a Bible ever again.
Okay.
But I still believe in a higher power. I still believe in like positive energy and good karma and, you know, just doing good to others, just for the sake of it and not just, you know, for some eternal reward or, you know, fear of eternal damnation or something like that. It's pretty much where I'm at nowadays.
Very good similar to where I believe too. That's it's and I think it's pretty common for people that have been in cults, mm-hmm. but and certainly for me, I mean, I saw the way people can manipulate the Bible and thought people have been mm-hmm. manipulating this book mm-hmm. for centuries. I'm not going yes. by that book, and I'm not going to let people yes. control me by manipulating the words in that book.
Yep, exactly.
I didn't ask you this during the story, and we're going to begin to wrap up, but were you able to celebrate holidays, birthdays, Christmas, or they were not allowed?
No, we never celebrated a birthday. The children could make an announcement at the gathering that they were thankful that their Ima, we called mother's Ima, father's Abba, you know, they could say, I'm thankful my Ima gave birth to me 9 years ago. Like, it was supposed to be this day of celebrating the mother, because the mother is the one who did all the hard work on the day the child was born.
Which is true.
You know, nobody's special just because they were born, because we were all born. So that's kind of what the premise was about birthdays there. There wasn't gifts for the child or, you know, things like that. If there could be a cake if somebody helped the child, but that would be, it'd be for the mother, like everything to honor the mother.
What about today?
We did, like, you know, the first birthday that came up after leaving was my youngest. He turned 7. We left in August and he turned 7 in December. And we gave him, like, you know, he invited his friends from school and we had musical chairs and
good
I just
for you.
Like, I just wanted him, awesome. You know, I wanted them to get that experience. But no, we didn't do Christmas because Christmas is pagan. Easter is pagan. You know, they really have nothing to do with the birth or death of Christ. You know, we did the festivals from the Old Testament, like Yom Kippur and Passover and Sukkot, and those old festivals are what we celebrated in the 12 tribes.
Me too. Not in the 12 tribes, in the house of Yahweh, but me too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yahweh. Yep. That's
all right. Yes. Tell us where we can find your book.
My book can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble online. And, you know, if you're local, it's in a lot of local Vermont bookstores.
Okay, and you're on social media?
Yep. I'm Tamara Matthew, author. I have a page on Facebook and Instagram.
All right. And all those links will be in the show notes.
Right.
Yep, for sure.
All right.
So thank you, Tamara, so much for coming on the show and sharing your story with us. We appreciate it, and I'm sure that your experience will help somebody out there in the audience listening.
Yeah, thank you. This
was a new cult for us, so... It just opened up my eyes as to, I've always said this, there's so many cults out there. We just don't know how many. And
right.
Just thank you for coming on and sharing your personal experience with this 12 tribe cult.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
We want to thank Tamara again so much for coming on the show and sharing her unique experience and unique story with us. Wow. I'm so impressed with where they are. I always love to hear people that leave and can do all that stuff right away, the birthdays, the Christmas, all that stuff, just because my deconstruction took so much longer.
Yeah. I really, really enjoyed that interview. She showed up prepared, and as she was telling her story, all these questions like you had, these cults that we interview and knowing your story about how long it took to put a Christmas tree up. That's always seems to, like, I want to ask that. That's why I said to her, I have a personal question. Where's your faith today? And I did want to ask, do you celebrate Christmas? Do you celebrate birthday? Right. But I kind of danced around it, 'cause I don't, you know, we always ask the guests before we record, is there anything out of bounds or anything? But sometimes I feel it's like I'm invading on something that's very sacred to them. And I don't know where they are in their recovery. So sometimes I might trigger them asking them a question like that. But I couldn't wait to ask, do you celebrate Christmas? Or, and the Halloween story was interesting.
Which was not on air, on mic, by the
way.
Oh,
it's right. We didn't record that.
So we'll share with the audience here that after we shut the mic off, we stopped recording, we started talking about that. And yes, she said that first year after they left, they immediately started celebrating Halloween, Christmas, birthdays, all of it. So they just dove right back in. So,
But how they handled Halloween while they were in the 12 tribe was that everybody would go up to this cabin somewhere in the mountains, and the one house, they would put somebody there to hand out candy to the trick-or-treaters. So this is the way I understood it. So they would look normal and the kids wouldn't be shunned something.
Maybe so the house didn't get teepeed. I don't know. They didn't really she wasn't even really sure. She said it might have just been muffins from their deli or something that they handed out. And maybe it was with some propaganda, you know, in the packaging. I don't know. You know, I'm
I
sure
don't
they
know.
Had some agenda. There was some ulterior motive there, but we don't know
what it was. Warms my heart to hear somebody that has endured something like that. Because two months in, she was already like
doubting
out of it.
Yeah.
To come out of it. And although she says she went to therapy, but she did kind of adjust, and her family adjusted rather quickly to living in the normal society that we live in, celebrating holidays and going to school and watching movies and things like that. So I really enjoyed today's interview.
Oh, I did too. I did too. The only other thing I want to touch on that I made a little note about, but we kind of moved past it pretty quickly in the interview process. Did you notice when she was talking about how you had to ask permission to go visit your family, did you notice the wording that they used, that they called it a burden, that they had to do a request to go visit your family was considered a burden. That wording is very, what is the word? There's a lot tied into that. That is subliminal. They're sending a message to you when you have to.
Well, they're afraid that the family will talk you out of it. Right. Like, what are you doing? And, you know, why don't you get out of there and yada, yada. And
That wording was purposeful. Yeah, that was my point, is that I was like, there's no reason that they called that a burden for a reason, because they considered it a burden.
As we say, these cults are very meticulous in how they, all their protocols and what they choose. And that Chinese menu we talk about, how they all pull from the same playbook. And
Clean and unclean rules that very paralleled my House of Yahweh teachings. That's all the very same stuff I learned, because it's all Old Testament teachings in the Bible, the 613 laws followed by actually most of the Jewish religions. So very interesting. But it was such a great interview, and I really enjoyed her and appreciated her coming on the show.
Absolutely.
And so thank you again to Mara for coming on the show, and thank all of you for tuning into Cultimatum. Your support, as always, is greatly appreciated. And if you enjoyed today's episode, if you could just take a moment to rate and review us on platforms such as Apple and Spotify, that really helps us out. And don't forget to follow, share, and keep listening to all of our latest episodes.
You can also connect with us by joining our Facebook group called Cultimatum Podcast, where we dive deeper into these important topics.
And you can also find us on additional social media platforms, including Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok, YouTube, and Threads.
If you have a personal experience with cults or human trafficking that you'd like to share, reach out to us at cultimatumpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And if you are an ex-cult member who is looking for any additional support, you can consider joining the Cult Escape and Recovery Group on Facebook.
And to hear more of me, you can check out my other podcast, The Anonymous Andrew Modern Dating Podcast. If you'd like to help us with the cost of maintaining the podcast, please show your support by clicking on the link in the show notes, buy us a cup of coffee. Every little bit helps our mission to spread awareness about cults and human trafficking.
And as always, stay safe, stay informed, and remember, you're not alone.